Good morning, everyone. The first argued case this morning is number 21-1635, American Patents, LLC, against Unified Patents, LLC. Mr. Thompson.
Good morning, Judge Newman, and may it please the Court. My argument will focus first on the reviewability of the Board's post-institution procedural decisions to expunge two rebuttal exhibits and to strike those exhibits and the associated arguments. After that, I will discuss why...
Mr. Thompson, I'm wondering why this isn't almost a frivolous appeal. You're talking about institution, which, of course, is non-appealable, non-admissibility of exhibits, which is a matter of discretion, and sealing of the identity of one of the United members, which seemingly has become moot because it's public. So what is this appeal designed to accomplish?
Your Honor, the appeal was designed to help us get our patent back. The patent was invalidated. The strategy that we took in front of the Board was to focus on the RPI issues because we thought under this Court's...
We're not arguing the merits here.
We're arguing the merits in the sense that we believe Unified's failure to name Samsung as an RPI in the petition and its decision to keep maintaining that position despite evidence to the contrary produced during discovery was something that was a flaw under 312A2 and that warrants the Board terminating the IPR.
Is termination of the IPR the only relief that you could get from the Board that would help you?
Termination of the IPR, at the very least, is the primary relief. I mean, I think it's possible that, I think the Board discussed this below, that if the Board were to find that Samsung were an unnamed RPI and then give Unified the opportunity to amend the petition to name Samsung, that might still have a beneficial effect on my client. I think that's less likely to benefit the client given the settlement with Samsung, but it's possible.
Even though you haven't raised any challenge to the patentability merits ruling, and which would not change according to whether there is it would not change if Samsung was now named as a co-petitioner.
The merits wouldn't change, Your Honor, but the Board's ability under statute to consider the petition would. I mean, 312A2 makes very clear that a petition shall not be considered if it fails to name all real parties.
Right, I'm just trying to focus. I mean, I guess I think I'm hearing your answer to be that, in fact, deinstitution is the only thing that you could get from the Board that could actually benefit you. So that you are here arguing, let's put aside expungement, and obviously Samsung is now nameable, so that's not an issue anymore. Is there any more work to be done on desealing? Wasn't there a joint motion filed to the Board or a joint email or something saying, please unseal the references to Samsung? Do you know, has that been acted on? Or do we have to order the Board to do that?
To my knowledge, it has not been acted on, and I think this Court will have to order the Board to do that.
And then the expungement. Expungement seems to me quite independent of institution. Do we have to reverse the expungement? I'll ask obviously the other side. I'm not even clear that they're even pressing any argument about the validity of expungement. But is that something that we need to do, and what benefit would it give you?
Our concern on the expungement issue, especially in light of the Board's own cases discussing their expungement precedent, is that the fact that the exhibits were expunged would limit this Court's ability to review them on appeal.
But it didn't, right? Because somehow or other, they became the last couple of pages of the joint appendix. And I don't see the other side objecting to our consideration of them to the extent we're considering the striking of the evidence. We obviously have to, and I'm not really sure what basis there is for expungement once it's conceded that obviously they get to, those documents get to come before us as part of the evidentiary argument.
Your Honor, our concern was under, the sharing case in particular, where it appeared that the excluded material was before this court in the joint appendix. This court decided to not consider it because it had been excluded below and had never been considered by the district court.
Well, we can find out from the other side. But on the striking and the reviewability, why is this not a matter in which the unreviewability of the RPI conclusion should mean unreviewability of the particular evidentiary objection that you're making? That is, the objection to the striking of two documents. Are those documents public now, or are those still sealed?
They are still sealed, Your Honor.
They're still sealed. So two documents. Why does one not follow from the other?
Thank you, Your Honor. One does not follow from the other because of the test that the Supreme Court and this court have used to decide the issue, and in light of the strong presumption in favor of judicial review. The test laid out in Cuso is not an effects-based test. It is a issue-based or grounds-based test. The court in SAS made very clear that a decision was not barred from review simply because it had some bearing on or some effect on the institution. I mean, that was the director's position in SAS, and that's essentially Unified's position here. But the court in SAS said that that reading of the statute overreads the statute and their precedent. And here, when you look at the Cuozzo test asks whether the grounds for the challenge are based in a statute that, you know, is closely tied to institution-related statutes, right? And so you have to look and see what is the actual ruling, which statutes are being applied. And so in Thrive, you know, you had a time bar that the court decided was solely based on institution. And in Cuozzo, you had...
Just to confirm that there would not be a time bar here because the lawsuit against Samsung was only like three months old when this petition was filed, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so in both those cases, what you had was situations in which the relevant statute being applied was something that actually only had meaning really during institution.
Can I ask you about this? So Cuozzo has a discussion relatively early in the meritsy discussion in which it distinguishes the Lindahl case. Now, the Lindahl case said, borrowing from and approving this court's longstanding, or the claims, the Court of Claims, our predecessor court's longstanding Scroggins doctrine, which said even when there is a statute that says the following decision shall not be reviewable, that some set of sufficiently important process errors can be reviewed. Is this such a case?
I think it is, Your Honor, and I think that's one reason why this case is different than Saiwi. So in Saiwi, for example, you had a decision that was about allowing additional discovery, which is a highly discretionary, limited right under the board's rules. This, in contrast, involves the APA right to submit rebuttal evidence. It's a fundamental statutory right that is not discretionary in the way the Saiwi question was. And putting aside the fact that Saiwi also involved the merits challenge to RPI issues, and that Saiwi didn't make an argument that sort of analytically applied the Cuozzo test differently to the discovery issue.
Right. I think Saiwi is easily distinguished, if only because the argument was not made. I guess I'm focusing more on whether you really have done enough to put this argument into the Lindahl-Scroggins category.
Your Honor, well, to answer your original question, I think this would be an important procedural right under Lindahl. I did not think that we needed to establish that to prevail because of SAS and Thrive making clear that the bar does not extend to issues about how an instituted IPR proceeds. And that makes sense because if you're dealing with something that's later than institution and it's a separate issue from institution, then that's going to be an issue that's based on rules or statutes that are not, you know, closely tied to institution. And so I think that is the line of cases that really most tells us here what the right outcome should be. I think this court's decisions in Windy City and in Unilock 2017 both confirm that, you know, the particular timing of this issue and the analytical separateness of the issue from the RPI merits decision.
What about this court's decision in Power Integrations? It's not a case that the red brief cited. You do mention it in passing. I don't know about in passing. You mention it in your gray brief. That case, I think, if I remember right, came up on mandamus. But the discussion, I thought, indicated that the evidentiary, not something like evidentiary challenges, because they were challenges to a decision that itself was non-reviewable, a institution decision, could not be recognized as outside the 314D non-reviewability bar without, couldn't be recognized as exceptions to that. Why is that not applicable here?
Your Honor, apologies because I haven't focused on Power Integrations on that particular issue, but I do think the evidentiary issue is an important difference that sort of also goes to the harmlessness issues in this case. An evidentiary issue oftentimes involves an implicit merits evaluation, right? So essentially, you might be saying whether something is, you know, relevant or whether it's cumulative, but you still have to have a mindset about what the actual factors are that are being applied. This is not that kind of issue. This is a procedural issue. I think it's before evidentiary, and we're literally trying to decide.
In the following sense, and again, I don't remember, is any part of the board decision confidential or not?
There are some, I think, discussions of licensing terms and things like that.
Okay, but this doesn't have anything to do with that. So the board actually cited the exhibit 1026 to which your 2035 and 2036 exhibits were responsive. And it cited them, page 43 and I think page 47. But then when the board says, here's why, even considering your argument about those exhibits, it said, we don't think that Samsung is a real party in interest because Unified, though it has, let's call them customers, is making its own independent decisions. Why doesn't that make the 2035 and 2036 exhibits well within the range of either harmlessness or discretionary in the sense that they could not meaningfully undermine the basis on which the board concluded that Samsung was not a real party in interest?
Your Honor, I think an important difference is the arguments we were making, I think we're heavily reliant on the evidentiary value of those exhibits. Criticizing a Unified's 1026 exhibit for not discussing certain things is one thing, but actually having an exhibit that shows why you can take a different inference, you know, why you can infer that Unified lost interest in this IPR as soon as Samsung settled, why you can infer that Unified, even if they don't file every IPR on Samsung's behalf, they file IPRs on some member's behalf in every case, or almost every case, and in this case, the only member who was implicated was Samsung. Those things, and I think NuVasive talks about this, just having some opportunity to address an issue does not mean the 556D right has been honored. Because I think we're entitled to the best way to do that. And here I think the best way was to have the court consider this particular evidence.
Okay. That was a helpful exchange, and thank you. We'll save your full rebuttal time. Let's hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Ms. McComas.
See if I can do this gracefully, right?
You'd be the first who ever could.
I'm hoping by the time I achieve that, I won't need it anymore. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm going to jump straight and respond to some of the questions that Judge Toronto asked American patents so we can get to the heart of it quickly. I believe you heard from opposing counsel, termination of the IPR is the relief we're seeking here. And termination of the institution based on a real party and interest question. We cannot escape that.
Okay, just before you, what are we supposed to do about the now public information that this mystery party was Samsung, which is, you now agree is public information? Is there anything for us to do about that? First of all, has the board responded to your joint request to proceed with some sort of unsealing?
I didn't check before I came today, but they haven't ruled on it yet, as far as
And what is your current stance on this expungement issue, which is exceedingly odd?
Okay. First, on the sealing, just one quick note. I think we let the board do its job. I mean, that's the process to have something lifted, and they may be slow about it, but we should expect them to do their job. I think it would be difficult for this court to issue some type of decision solely on a moot question that's really no longer before the court when the procedures have been taken place in the board to make that happen, even if they're slow.
Okay, expungement.
Okay, on expunction.
Expunction, is that the?
Well, maybe you're right, actually.
I don't know. Okay.
I think the issue for this court is the way American Patents argued, they argued the issue of expungement with respect to pleadings at the end or evidence at the end of the case after final written decision. That's not what we have here. These two exhibits were expunged as part of the striking ruling. And that's done under a separate regulation. So it's basically, this is not part of what's properly before me. I'm going to strike it and expunge it. And that's how that regulation operates. So I think you can't reach the expunction question in that instance without also reaching the striking issue, which we've decided is not really reviewable.
Well, I guess this is what confuses me. It's one thing to say I strike the evidence in the sense that it's not going to be considered. It's another thing to, not even sure what this expungement or expunction thing is. You agree it had to come into the joint appendix. It's something that in order to review the striking ruling, we have to have in front of us. So what's going on with expungement?
I treated it as kind of an offer of proof. That's how I understood it, kind of similar to what happens in district court with an offer of proof. It's in the record for purposes of what you would review, but for purposes, it's my understanding under that regulation, what they're saying is it's not part of my record that I, as the board, reviewed. So that's the distinction to me. And I think that's different than, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you.
No. How does that differ from striking? They did review it until they struck it, and then they struck it and said, we're not going to consider it on the merits. So what else is there?
Right. I think under that regulation, that's exactly what's happening. That's different than the regulation that American Patents briefed here, which is at the end of the case, when it's confidential material, I expunge it for all purposes. Same word, different effect. Under the two regulations. That regulation allows for striking and expunction. I think that's right under that circumstance. but that's just different. And it's not that this board can't review it. I think that is a distinction that probably does distinguish it from the Shearing case, which is a post-final written decision expungement for all purposes. So this very confidential information is as if it never existed.
Okay, so I think I'm done with that detour. So it seems to me that the heart of the merits dispute here is about the refusal to consider 2035 and 2036 and whether that refusal is reviewable by us and so on. So.
Right. Obviously, we think it's not reviewable. I do want to go to one point on the merits. If the court gets there, it is relevant to whether or not this fits Lindahl-Scroggins. as much as American Patents tries to cast its appeal as a due process challenge, it's really just their failure to follow the rules. The whole issue here is they could have sought leave to go beyond what the normal SIR reply obligations or opportunities are, and they just didn't do it. And Belden tells us that's the process. They said they have options. There are things you can do. You just have to ask.
So is there what was it that required them to seek leave to file with an authorized SIR reply evidence that, by assumption in this question, is directly responsive to new evidence that you introduced with your reply? Yes. What required them to seek leave?
The fact that they didn't have a right to SIR reply except that was granted to them in the scheduling order.
And did the scheduling order say your SIR reply on any SIR reply, even on this issue, may not include any evidence, even if that evidence is directly responsive to what the reply added?
It did not, but the board in the institution decision specifically said, we expect everyone to follow the trial practice guide. That is at Appendix 648 in footnote 9. It says, we expect the parties to follow our rules and the guidance set forth in the trial practice guide. I think American Patents is hard pressed to suggest they really didn't understand that those were the rules they were following. And the trial practice guide is very clear that the SIR reply is limited. And it only allows cross-examination evidence. And then the trial practice guide goes further. If you want something beyond that, there's a mechanism to do it. You just have to ask.
And do those non-binding trial practice guide rules apply to the particular situation where the board has authorized the petitioner to introduce new evidence in reply, because this is this RPI issue that hadn't been discovery on, so you're kind of starting the process there. Do those trial practice guide principles apply even to a situation in which, by universal practice, and the APA, was it 556 or something, or 554, says you do actually have a right to rebut?
Right.
To submit rebuttal evidence.
Right. They had a chance to submit rebuttal evidence. They rebutted at multiple stages. There was a patent owner preliminary response. They got a SIR reply there. They had a patent owner response.
Not in response to your Exhibit 1026, which said, look at all of the IPRs we file without, I don't know, I forget exactly what it was, 25 instances to show just how separate you are from your clients.
Actually, now you're buying what they're selling. The chart that they claim to be rebutting is a rebuttal to their 2023 exhibit, which was all of that information, just not in a pretty chart form. So this is SIR rebuttal evidence. They are trying to go one step further and have a SIR rebuttal. And what this court said in Belden is, we want everybody to have a word. We want to have a last word on evidence, but it's got to stop somewhere. And by the time you get to a SIR reply, which we will allow in certain instances, there has to be a justification for it. It is not unreasonable, arbitrary, in any way impractical for an expectation that if you want to go beyond what the rules are that are set, that you have to ask permission. And so, that's what didn't happen here.
So what I hear you saying, to summarize, is that the principles of due process that would apply in the courts don't apply if the administrative agency doesn't feel like following them.
No, not at all. I'm saying due
process. That's what you just said?
No.
There may be an issue which has been raised inadequately, not fully explored. Never mind. You had your shot. You weren't clairvoyant enough to foresee it, so you lose.
Quite the contrary, Your Honor. What I'm saying is they had a mechanism under due process that they could have asked for.
Exactly. You're saying that the due process, which would clearly, in a district court, if there is an issue which is raised later in the proceedings. Each side would have a fair opportunity to explore it, not before us. We're an administrative agency. We've got rules. You know the rules. That ends it.
No, because if they had followed the rules and followed
exactly,
the procedures...
Exactly, didn't follow the rules.
It is exactly the same as if you're in district court and you fail to make disclosures at a certain time. The court in that instance has lots of discretion to say it's not fair for you to go forward with that. We have very specific procedures that were in play here. It's very difficult to look at this record and decide that American Patents didn't know what those rules were because they followed them in every other instance and insisted on them. But then when it came time to putting in new evidence in a reply brief, they, in a sur reply brief, which would be sur rebuttal, that's basically taking the evidence they put in their patent owner response and just twisting it in a new way. They didn't ask permission and they had to. That's what I'm saying, is that there was a procedure to follow and they just didn't follow it. But let's talk about, I don't want to lose sight of the reviewability question and make sure that I've answered your question on why this is not in the quozo exceptions. It is closely tied. And I think Your Honor raised power.
Well, I'm not quite sure under quozo whether the closely tied principle, how that relates to the Lindahl-Scroggins principle. Let's just assume for a moment that Lindahl-Scroggins standard is part of what would come within the exceptions talked about two paragraphs later or something in quozo, with due process,
shenanigans,
whatever.
Right. Okay, I'm not sure. I want to make sure I answer your question correctly.
Lindahl approved Scroggins, which had long said we have a facially, seemingly absolute statutory non-reviewability provision for some sort mm-hmm. of OPM-related decision. And Scroggins had long said, and Lindahl approved that over dissent, and then Quozo seems to maintain Lindahl, that the fact that the ultimate decision is not reviewable does not mean that important procedural decisions leading to that decision are themselves unreviewable. And the question, I guess, that I'm focusing on is why this isn't that.
Right. Got it. Because one, as you noted, this is harmless error. This is a minor issue in the grand scheme of what the board did. But I think that the type of procedural due process issues that they're talking about in Lindahl-Scroggins and then in Quozo is something much more extreme than what we're looking at here. It's not simply a discretionary decision not to let a couple of pieces of additional surrebuttal evidence in. Perhaps an example, I did try to think through this yesterday, how to answer that question. If there was no permission to file a patent owner response, or they didn't allow rebuttal evidence in the context of the patent owner response, there wasn't the wealth of evidence you had here, and they shut them down early, said, nope, fifth time I've heard this, I'm not going to allow it. You would reach a threshold at one of those where you've so exceeded your authority as the board under the AIA that should be reviewable. That's not this case.
What were the bases on which the board struck this evidence? One I think was, tell me if I'm wrong, you didn't ask, you could have. What else did the board say?
Right, there were two grounds. One was that you didn't ask. The other was that it's new evidence beyond the scope of what's allowed by a surreply. So under the trial practice guide, which I said applies here, which I've told you is going to be our guiding light, the surreply requires, is limited to cross-examination evidence without leave, and you didn't seek leave. So I see those as two separate grounds. Notably, American Patents didn't address the second one. They only addressed the first with respect to trial practice guide.
What was the basis in the board decision, the ultimate board decision, A60, 63, whatever, for saying, here's why we think Samsung was not a real party in interest?
I have that. They went through the AIT process for the second time in their decisions because they had to do it at the institution decision too. And they weighed all of the evidence and said, when I weigh these facts, I take into account the fact that yes, members are from time to time benefited from what Unified Patents does, but they focused heavily on the evidence that Unified acted independently and all of the facts that showed it didn't communicate with its members on specific strategies in advance and went through a litany. That's at final written decision that starts at page 47 and goes on for multiple pages as to that analysis.
So do you think that the board's position is that a entity that is making decisions to benefit its customers does not process does not make the customer a real party in interest as long as the entity seeking to benefit them is acting independently? Is that the principle? That's the only one that I'm getting out of what you just said or remembering from the board decision.
Well, that's the emphasis that from those pages. There's a 50-page long analysis of all of the AIT factors.
Right, but what's important is the one or two or maybe three, however many it was, that the board said, here's why we think this entity, Unified, which is in existence for the purpose of, among other things, serving its customers, like its members, and is clearly bringing IP petitions that have some correlation, which is the point of their evidence, with their customers' lawsuits. And I think the board acknowledges, obviously, there's some kind of benefit being conferred and maybe even an eye on who's being benefited, namely its customers. But as long as they're acting independently, we don't think the customers are real parties in interest. If there's more to it than that, I guess I'd like to know what there is.
There is more. To be fair, I felt like this part was not reviewable, so I tried hard not to prep on all of the merits. But if you look at the analysis,
right, if reviewability turns on some sense of the importance of this evidence, as Lindahl and Scroggin suggest, one actually does have to get into understanding what the harmlessness is, as you say. One, I think, actually, at least I think one has to get into something about the basis of the decision to see whether this exclusion of two documents is a little thing or a big thing.
Right. I would suggest to you, we know it's a little thing because the board addressed specifically the 2023, Exhibit 2023 and Exhibit 1026 and the significance of those and then weighed that against the other factors, including the most significant of which is the independence of, but what goes into that are the other facts of, cases that didn't involve members and other issues, that this was not the sole fact that the board relied upon. But with respect to these specific exhibits and the fact that this was sur rebuttal on issues that were already there, it took into account both those exhibits, the facts that they yielded, which Exhibit 2036 didn't add to that, it simply recast the argument about it. Those facts were already in the record. And the board took into account those facts, and it found in weighing the factors under AIT that it didn't tip the scale. Therefore, I think it's safe to find from the board's findings that it would not have been a turning point or a scale-tipping piece of evidence if it had come in. And it's the same thing with an offer of random offer to settle, to reach a settlement or talk about settlement before the institution decision occurred. That just wasn't something, if you look at the board's findings, beginning at final written decision at Appendix 47, it's very clear that those are not the things that are pushing the board, that they did take into account the fact that settlements occurred, that licensings happened, that that was a benefit to the members. But when you weighed that against the activity, the decisions, the fact that cases were pursued that didn't involve members or didn't directly benefit members, that the mission of Unified Patents was being seen was to knock out these types of patents that didn't have a lot of value, and that that was a tipping point that made this evidence not important. So from the harmless error standpoint, I think that's helpful. The other piece of harmless error, and I know I'm out of time, the other piece of harmless error is the separate point that it would not have made a difference here. Because there was no time bar issue, at most what we get is to go back down and change the petition so that it adds a new name to it. And that would be literally all that happens here. It does not make the institution go away. And I know I'm out of time, so I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Any questions for counsel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make 3 points in rebuttal. For Judge Toronto's point about Lindahl, I think Your Honor characterized Lindahl as being a case
where... Could you speak up a little, please?
Sorry. I think Your Honor characterized Lindahl as being a case where the statutory language was very clear on barring review, and the court still recognized sort of an important procedural rights as being things that might be still reviewable. I think we are very far from that sort of situation here, because 314A, the actual language of that statute, does not apply in any way to this particular decision. These decisions were not determinations about whether to institute, and they were not determinations made by the director. Obviously, 314D would still cover, board decisions that are implementing the director's authority to institute, or essentially, interpreting statutes that are purely institution-related. But Congress would never have expected the director to be making decisions about procedural issues during the course of an institute review. That's the board's responsibility under the AA, not the director's. And so I think there's no reason to think that Congress intended for these particular decisions to be barred from judicial review, and certainly not the clear and convincing indicators that you need under Quozo to rebut the presumption. Second, I think counsel mentioned a couple points that I think were made for the first time about the institution decision somehow being an order on us to comply with the TPG. Again, that was not presented in the briefs, but I certainly don't think that language that she recited represents an order. And in any event, the scheduling order was later than that. So I think the scheduling order would still trump that, and the scheduling order placed no restrictions whatsoever on what evidence could be included with the cert reply. And in fact, I think the analogy was made to district court disclosures. Well, district court disclosures are by rule. You actually know what the rules are. They're set forth in writing, and you comply with them. Or if you can't comply, you seek leave from the court to not comply. The TPG is not a rule. In fact, the provision that Unified is relying on from the TPG was added to the rules after this decision was made. If the TPG can be enforced like a rule, then why are there rules at all? I mean, the TPG is something that board members can use and implement in their cases if they choose. The board could have issued a scheduling order that expressly limited our ability to provide rebuttal evidence. We then would have sought leave to submit the exhibits. And you still may have APA issues in terms of the rebuttal evidence right, but I think it's unfair to hold our failure to seek leave against us when no rule and no order require that we do so. And finally, I disagree that the only remedy below is termination. 312A2 again says that no petition can be considered that doesn't comply with the RPI requirement. The board has terminated IPRs before based on failure to comply with this requirement, especially in situations where the petitioner has insisted on a position that the board ultimately rejects about a particular RPI. If there are any questions, Your Honor, Your Honors?
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. It's well presented. Dickinson under submission.